We get it rolling with a good friend of the show. He's been on several times to talk music and his wonderful series, The Vinyl Dialogues. Volume 4 is out right now. It's called From Studio to Stylus, The Making of Albums in the 1960s and 1970s. Mike Morish, great to have you back with us here on Downtown.
Thank you, Rich. How you doing, man?
I'm doing great. How did the storm treat you?
We dodged a bit of a bullet. About 6 inches. I had some help, and I got the driveway cleared in about an hour, so it wasn't bad.
Well, that's good. Glad to hear that. Well, the new book, like the three that preceded it, is absolutely wonderful, and I've told you before, I think along with entertaining reading, you're doing so much for music history with these conversations you've had, and this time around, my goodness, what a list of folks. Peter Yarrow of Peter, Paul, and Mary, Danny Hutton from Three Dog Night, Tony Tennille, Timothy B. Schmidt from the Eagles and Poco, and Russell Tompkins Jr., Shirley Austin Reeves of the Shirelles, and so many more, and some great stories as well. We had Peter Noon on our show a few weeks ago, but we didn't get the story you got, which is how the band Herman's Hermits really didn't want to release one of their biggest songs as a single.
Yeah, as you know, Peter's a friend of your show as well, and he's a great storyteller. He loves to talk. He's one of those guys you just ask one question, wind him up, and let him go. I drew a blank. Is it Henry VIII or is it Mrs. Brown, You've Got a Lovely Daughter?
Mrs. Brown, You've Got a Lovely Daughter, because they thought it would hurt the image of the band and would not be a hit.
Exactly. And they were part of, as you know, the British invasion, and they got stuck in a situation where they were honoring commitments that they had made prior to hitting it big. So they had a combination of once they hit it big, they were booking a lot of shows, but they honored all the previous commitments to some of the smaller clubs and things like that, and they were on the road all the time. But they were not crazy at all about releasing Mrs. Brown. They thought they were on a different path. They thought it was a novelty song, and and as Peter will tell you, they were wrong. It hit for them and it made them even bigger at the time.
Well, it's a familiar theme, artists that don't want to release songs that go on to become huge hits for them. And another one is recounted in the book when you talked with singer and producer Ron Dante about one of Barry Manilow's biggest, I Write the Songs, and he wanted nothing to do with it because that was one he didn't write.
He did not write it. He was written by Bruce Johnston of the Beach Boys. It took record producer Clive Davis to talk Barry into eventually recording I Write the Songs. But Barry resisted that for quite some time, finally came around. And again, it was another example of one of those songs that the artist didn't want to do, and it ended up being a big hit for him.
You've got a great chapter, too, on the making of Carly Simon's No Secrets and the wonderful story. You would think if you have Harry Nilsson in the studio singing backup, you're going to be in pretty good shape, but things just weren't going the way they wanted them to go for producer Richard Perry until another surprise guest showed up.
Yeah, I got this story from Jimmy Ryan, who was a lead guitarist for Carly on that album, and they were having trouble with the song, and Paul McCartney happened to be in the studio, and Carly asked him, would you like to sing backup on this? We're having trouble getting it. And Paul said, sure. And I think it might have been a one or two take with McCartney on backgrounds with the other background singers at the time. And they got the take that they were looking for with Sir Paul on the background.
We're talking with Mike Morish. His new book is called From Studio to Stylus. Some great conversations in the book. And I love the story that was told to you and the stories told to you by Elliot Lurie of Looking Glass. Of course, best known for Brandy, was such a mega hit in the early 70s. But even the story of the making of that, for anybody who doesn't know how the music business works, that's a great tale of how important the production aspect is, because it didn't all come together until they had the right backing mix.
No, and that is indeed true. I got to tell you, I have contacted Elliot via Facebook, and so we remain in contact over Facebook. And I just got an email from him the other day, and as you know, Rich, we've discussed this before. One of my goals with these projects, well, the two big goals. One, they're just so much fun to talk to the artists whose music I grew up with, and to get the background stories on them. But the other thing is, I want to get it right. I really want to get it right through their eyes and their perspectives. And I just got an email from Elliot. We just sent him a copy of the book. He said he was quite complimentary. He said it was the most detailed and accurate telling of the story, of the Brandy story, and the making of that song and that album, Looking Glass album. So I was very gratified with his blessing on how that turned out. But yes, it was. There's a lot of inside baseball in that chapter on the evolution of the song itself, the recording of the song itself, and how it, again, didn't turn out like they wanted to at the beginning. They got a new mix in. They did some studio work on it, and it ended up being. Elliot calls the Looking Glass a 1.5 hit wonder. A lot of people, and I did touch on this in the chapter too. Their follow-up single was a record called Jimmy Loves Mary Ann.
Which I love. I actually like that song better than Brandy.
It's a very, very catchy tune. I like it a lot, too. It was a top 40 song for him. So Looking Glass ended up being a 1.5 hit wonder, according to Elliot. Before the band split up.
I was so thrilled when I opened the book and looked at the chapter headings to see that you talked to Mary Kay Place. When I was in country radio as a kid all those years ago, that was one of my favorite songs to play, one of the few hits I can think of by a fictional character.
Yeah, and you know what, Rich, that relates, and you'll probably know this story. That goes back to the first volume of the Vinyl Dialogues, and the chapter on Brewer and Shipley and their song One Toke Over the Line.
Right.
And as you know, because you've read it, One Toke Over the Line was performed in the early 70s, once it became a hit for Brewer and Shipley. It was performed on the Lawrence Welk Show. And there's a very famous YouTube video of two of the Lawrence Welk singers singing essentially a song about drugs, and they don't seem to be aware that this what the song is about. And so for that very first book, The Vinyl Dialogues, I tried to track down one of the singers, the Lawrence Welk singers, by the name of Gail Farrell, the female. The other singer was Dick Dale, and I wanted to know for that book, you know, what the Lawrence Welk singers do and when they do it, and did they know what they were singing about. And to make a long story short, she wouldn't tell me because she was writing a one-woman play for herself, which has since been debuted. And it was through her, Gail Farrell, who was a friend of Mary Kay Place, and she said, and she was telling me the story. I remember the television show from when I was a kid, but I did not remember that Mary Kay had made an album, a couple of albums. And even had people like Willie Nelson involved in her music. And so she's the one that hooked me up with Mary Kay Place. And Mary Kay was a fabulous interview. And it was one of those things, Rich, where she said, nobody's asked me about this for 40 years. So she was very happy to share the stories, and it was a wonderful interview. And I think the chapter turned out real well.
We heard some of the stories about the captain and Tennille and their relationship, but to see it in the book in Tony Tennille's words, that was heartbreaking to read about.
It was. My editor said the same thing when they read that chapter, that it was a heartbreaking tale. And Tony has said this in her book, and she said it in interviews to other people rather than just me. But love did not keep the cabin of Tennille together. And he, according to her, just did not return any of the love all those years. And I will say this as well, Rich. That was a tough interview to listen to. She didn't pull any punches at all and didn't dodge any questions at all. And I had read the book prior to the interview. And it was hard to listen to because, again, those are two artists that we grew up with that we loved their music, and it was hard to listen to.
The fascinating story of Karen Carpenter's solo album was really terrific. The album produced by Phil Ramone, and then depending on who you believe, whether it was Richard Carpenter who didn't want it to come out or not, or if Karen herself wasn't pleased with it, but I thought that was really a fascinating chapter.
It was, and a lot of people don't remember that album because it was not released when it was recorded in 1980. As the story goes, Richard Carpenter had entered drug rehabilitation, so he was unavailable. Karen wanted to still keep making music, so she decided to do a solo album with the intent of actually getting rid of the girl next door, Goody Two Shoes image. She wanted to spice up that album, and by then the Carpenters were some of the biggest artists of the 70s, and the producers and the record company didn't particularly like that there was going to be maybe a sexier Karen Carpenter album out there, and so it was not event. I think it was 1993. It wasn't released until 1993, and yeah, there was a whole lot of my own take, based on the people that I interviewed who were in the band, in her band, and she also, as you know, used Billy Joel's backing band as the backing band for her solo album, and I talked to those guys, and they thought it was a great album. They thought that Karen achieved what she set out to do, but it just never got released when it was recorded, and of course, she subsequently died a few years later, and the music wasn't released until the 90s.
Mike Morse with us here on Downtown, his new book, From Studio to Stylus. I was very interested to read about a much maligned group of the Starland Vocal Band of Afternoon Delight fame, and to read that some people you might not expect had some respect for what they were able to do with their vocal performances.
They were, and of course, we all know what Afternoon Delight is in reference to. I believe we all know that. One of the first things I was able to get from the artist on that one was the where the name of the song came from, and actually that came off a menu of an eatery in Georgetown, Washington D.C. That was called an Afternoon Delight. It was some type of breakfast, brunch type of meal, and that's where it came.
I'll have what she's having, right?
Yeah, exactly. So I thought that was pretty interesting. But yes, once they got into the studio, they recorded a Paul Simon song, and Paul actually hung out in the studio a little bit. This was right after Still Crazy After All These Years, the Paul Simon album, was released, I believe, in 75. The Starland Vocal Band actually got to hear a copy of the finished album before Paul himself did. But Paul was in the studio with them, and he was very complimentary of the work that they were doing at the time. Again, as we know, they ended up being a one-hit wonder for the most part, too. The Starland Vocal Band, but that's just a classic song, and the story behind that's fabulous.
So, Mike, yeah, you've talked to so many talented people for these four books through the years. I certainly hope there are more volumes to come. Who's on that wish list, though? Who's your white whale that you'd love to track down?
Elton John and Bernie Taupin, the songwriting duo. That's one I'll probably never get. Elton doesn't really need to do any interviews, and a lot has been written about his music and his career. But I'd just love to have a conversation with him. And then, of course, Paul McCartney. I try to get Carole King. I'd love to talk to Carole King, James Taylor. But there's a level of artist I can't quite get to. But I've been fortunate to talk to a lot of people that whose music I grew up with and influenced me. Rich, there's nothing cooler than having Daryl Hall or a John Oates on the phone and hearing the stories about She's Gone or Sarah Smile, those kinds of songs that we grew up with in the 70s. And that's just it's just fabulous.
Well, it's another wonderful read. Volume 4 of the Vinyl Dialogues, From Studio to Stylist, The Making of Albums in the 1960s and 70s. Mike, again, thanks for the great work in putting this together, and thanks, as always, for making time for us.
Thanks, Rich. Appreciate it.
That's Mike Morris here on Downtown.